Namaste, welcome to Perseverance IAS Weekly, where we'll be discussing about the highlights of the past 1 week. At the end of every week, Perseverance IAS, I'll be doing a weekly roundup of all the important news items from the past 1 week. I think I'm repeating myself, but nonetheless, let us start. The first article is a reform wave Lakshadweep could do without. So, give you a little bit of background, most of the controversy seems to be surrounding the concept called Island Development Authority. So, the Island Development Authority is not new. This was set up during the premiership of Mr. Rajiv Gandhi when he was the Prime Minister of India. So, IDA was, that is the Island Development Authority, was approved in the year 1988, and it had the framework that was centered around the development of India's island territories. Now, the entire core concept or the core mission of IDA is to sort an environmentally sound strategy for both islands and island groups for better exploitation of marine resources that surround these island territories of India. Now, there was a concept to use the marine resources surrounding these islands and also to use the land resources coming out of these island territories. Now, since the inception of IDA, they wanted the Lakshadweep island to be open for international tourism. Even if you look at the statements made by the current administrator of Lakshadweep Islands, Mr. Patel, he talks about how the entire idea behind the slew of reforms that were being brought to develop the Lakshadweep territories on par with Maldives and make the Lakshadweep Islands as a hub for international tourism. Now, they want to follow the Maldives model for the development of Lakshadweep. Now, what are the legislations that were introduced by the administrator of Lakshadweep? One of the legislations was the Lakshadweep Development Authority Regulation of 2021, which intends to develop Lakshadweep like neighboring Maldives. If you have read the draft of this legislation itself or the legislation as such, it specifically talks about making Lakshadweep territories a renowned international tourist destination. Now, the plan, but the rejecting of the Maldives plan or the Maldives model as such we call it, and the plan for Lakshadweep required that the industry had to be people-centric and enrich the fragile coral ecology of the Lakshadweep. Now, the problem seems to be that majority of the population that is residing in Lakshadweep Islands are earning their income from fishing. As a result of this, there has been a lot of income disparities that have been brewing in the island territories of Lakshadweep. Now, there has been a status quo that has been being maintained in the territories of Lakshadweep for the past few years. And this has led to, according to the officials, this has led to a stagnation of growth in terms of economy, in terms of people, in terms of social development also. Overall, all facets of life were being found to be in a stagnant state of existence. Now, the government has recognized that the need to develop policies for enhancing employment opportunities that are environmentally friendly, because at the end of the day, these are fishermen dependent on fisheries. And you have to also understand that the infrastructure of Lakshadweep Islands was also crumbling. Now, they want to come up with new sanitational methodologies. They wanted new waste disposal systems, and they wanted to improve access to drinking water. And they wanted to ensure that the youth of this island were introduced to modern technologies and modern educational structures and systems, so that they prefer traditional occupation jobs and they go for an employed salaried jobs. One thing that we have to understand is whatever the policies that were being brought by the administrator are in fact, irrespective of which side you take in the conversation as this, these are developmental legislations. So when you talk about developmental legislations in a democratic country, they have to come from the people, and they have to be accepted by the people also, right? It has to be people centric. Again, the development is for the people, so it has to be development, people centric policies. Now what Lakshadweep needs right now is a policy that is inclusive of the people and inclusive of the environment that Lakshadweep holds to. So it is an ecologically very sensitive region, and whatever the policy that these administrators or the administration as such of Lakshadweep is thinking about implementing, it has to have the core components of conservation of environment and protection of the ecology in Lakshadweep Islands, and a proper management of natural resources that Lakshadweep holds, along with consultation with the people of Lakshadweep who reside in Lakshadweep Islands. Now, is that thing impossible? No, it is not impossible. It is absolutely plausible. There is a fine balance that can be attained when these policies are being framed, where the infrastructure of the Union Territory is being developed, not at the cost of ecology, but for the betterment and as a boost to ecology and the people that reside in. Again, you have to take into the consultation process route in coming out with policies. That is what I wanted to talk about, because the policy seems to be good, but the lack of interaction with the local population and the considerations for the environmental conservation seems to be the sticking points out of these legislations. Moving on to the next article, India must not miss the cryptocurrency bus. I think the answer lies with RBI's policy, or RBI's answer a few days back when the committee of RBI met, and when question was raised regarding the cryptocurrencies to the governor Shaktikant Das. He said that there are a lot of concerns that that surround cryptocurrencies. So to this, my answer has been that you have to apply or adopt the Russian model or the Chinese model. Let us understand what the Chinese model is. The Chinese government stance regarding the cryptocurrencies is very, very, very clear. They said that you cannot use cryptocurrencies in the mainland of China, but you can develop cryptocurrencies and send them elsewhere. That is what the Chinese have been doing. This is the very intelligent aspect of it. They said that you cannot trade cryptocurrencies or exchange cryptocurrencies as legal tender inside China, but you can create cryptocurrencies inside China and send them outside. So few of the cryptocurrencies that we are seeing right now that are gaining traction are actually emanating out of China or Hong Kong particularly, because it has been well established by this point of now that Hong Kong has been completely taken over by the Chinese. Now, when people say a cryptocurrency that is emanating out of China mainland means, people don't generally associate credibility with it. So what these developers out of China are doing, they're using the Hong Kong name, and they're saying that these Chinese developers are selling cryptocurrencies, that these cryptocurrencies are coming out of Hong Kong. So again, the policy should be that you cannot use in India, at least give the permission to create cryptocurrencies in India and use them elsewhere. At least you get that establish a structure that is in place when, if and when the RBI decides to legalize cryptocurrencies, you can clearly integrate it into our economy. There are a lot of advantages as to cryptocurrencies that are being cryptocurrency technology. At least you know the blockchain technology that can be incorporated into our economic structure, so that whatever the problems that we are suffering with financial fraud or black money or whatever you call it, they can be immediately weeded out of our society. But again, there are a lot of concerns that the financial institutions and the government seems to be juggling right now. That is why we don't have a clear-cut case of what the cryptocurrency market or the policy in India is. Now, what has been the Indian stand as to cryptocurrencies? Both law enforcement agencies and taxation agency, our income tax department, said you have to ban these cryptocurrencies because they are using for cryptocurrencies for illegal activities. Yes, there is a lot of proof that cryptocurrencies are being used for illegal activities. But we are not talking about the cryptocurrency as such. We are talking about the underlying blockchain technology that is being used in cryptocurrencies. So the point that both law enforcement and tax agencies are raising is valid. A lot of transactions that take place on cryptocurrencies are being diverted for illicit means, illicit activities. So after due process and due consideration in 2008, I think RBI came out with a notice or a memo. I don't remember it actually, but they came out with stating that financial institutions should not support cryptocurrency transactions. And subsequently, a bill was filed in front of the Supreme Court. I think in the mid of 2020, the Supreme Court overturned this. Direction from RBI. Now, what is the problem here? You have a Supreme Court judgment saying that you cannot block transactions on cryptocurrencies. But what I found recently was companies were doing shadow banning of transactions on cryptocurrencies. Particularly in the case of HDFC and other major banks, when people were trying to buy cryptocurrency or sell cryptocurrency, particularly buy cryptocurrency from these bank accounts, that is the money being converted from rupee form to a cryptocurrency form, for example, Bitcoin or Dogecoin or whatever you call them, Ethereum or something like that, these banks were not allowing transactions when the transaction is being done from a individual to a cryptocurrency exchange or a cryptocurrency purse company. So that is the major problem here. These transactions, though Supreme Court overturned the order given by the RBI, companies are still performing their own self-imposed shadow ban on cryptocurrency transactions. As I said, these people are still blocking, and there is a draft bill that has been circulating inside the walls of the parliament and the government of India, including the every department that deals with financial aspects of Indian ecosystem, that we kind of have to regularize what cryptocurrency technology is to Indian financial system. But the bill has, though there is a lot of support for it, there is a lot of skepticism and a lot of pushback against the bill also. Now, you heard few years back that RBI was in the process of that they are going to use the blockchain technology and come out with a digital rupee like what the digital yuan has been used. And that is what the Chinese are doing, right? Chinese have come out with their own digital version of their for currency, and they have been trying to centralize that ecosystem through a process of decentralization, which worked out in certain areas and didn't work out in certain areas. It's a touch and go with the Chinese attempt at digitizing their currency. But what we are trying to do is we are trying to decouple cryptocurrencies from their underlying blockchain technology. The idea seems to be that we don't need the cryptocurrency aspect of it. What we need is the blockchain technology that runs, that cryptocurrency runs on, because blockchain technology seems to be very effective in terms of providing a transparent transaction record. Now, what is the problem here? My personal understanding of the situation is there is a clear-cut lack of understanding of what cryptocurrencies are and what cryptocurrencies can do to an financial ecosystem. So if the government is willing to adopt cryptocurrencies as a mainstay or a main for at least a extension of our fiat currency system, I think that would bring about a lot of changes into transparency in terms of transactions in India. There is a lot of opaqueness in transactions that are being carried out in India. And when you talk about FDIs that are coming into India, imagine the highest percentage of FDIs coming out of Mauritius to India. I leave it to your own imagination what that investments are. I am not going to comment as to why the investments are coming only from Mauritius and that too highest number from. What is Mauritius, that island, has to offer to India in terms of FDI? So there is a lot of opaqueness that surrounds our economic system, and it is high time for India to adopt new technologies to bring some sort of transparency into our economic transactions. That is the only way that government of India can ensure we get a society that is free of corruption or something like that. And that includes bringing regulations. So the way forward should be that there should be a digital policy in place that uses the good aspects or good principles of cryptocurrencies and the underlying technologies and punishes the bad aspects of the cryptocurrency technologies. So a balance should be struck between these two, and regulatory uncertainties that India is facing right now, and particularly on the cryptocurrency technology, clearly shows that we need a good policy that answers, or at least tries to answer, what the cryptocurrency is throwing at us right now. So this first, we have to get rid of this mix and match go off policy. Make up your mind, you are allowing cryptocurrencies in India or not. Don't do this shadow banning, don't do these memos. So when Supreme Court of India itself said that you cannot block such transactions, people are still going ahead and blocking these transactions. So there is a duality or dichotomy of policy understanding. And my humble opinion is that there is a clear lack of understanding as to what this technology is and what it can do. It is high time for the government of India to come out with a clear policy, or at least come out with their official stance, whether they are for it or they are against it. Because whether we like it or not, the next phase of a financial revolution is going to be in cryptocurrencies only. The cryptocurrency market is booming like never before. You have multiple coins, but the respective ones like Bitcoin, Ethereum and other coins, at least top five, are having huge backings, and they are worth about 14 to 15 billion on the onset itself. Now moving on to the next article, I get a little bit angry when we talk about cryptocurrencies, but moving on to the next article, Statehood Day of Goa. Now 18th December of 1961, the Indian government officially took military action against the Portuguese who were ruling Goa, and that culminated into the liberation of Goa and its official merger with Union of India. So to give you a little bit of history of it, we know that the Portuguese conquered Goa in 1510, I think, and made it a colony of their own. And after that, there has been going on back and forth as to who owns Goa, what happens with Goa. But in 1950, the Indian government tried to have a diplomatic through diplomatic means, they wanted to free Goa from the Portuguese government. And they started negotiations with the Portuguese government for the independence of Goa. And like everywhere, people don't like to let go of their colonies. So the Portugal government refused. And there was a Goan movement also, which was supported by the Indian independence leaders, like particularly Jawaharlal Nehru, Ram Manohar Lohia, and Rajendra Prasad was also a critical part of this support of movement of Indian independent leaders for the movement independence of Goa from the clutches of Portuguese. And I think in the year 1954, I think the support of the United Front of Goans was also being brought up to the surface of the movement again to free or get an independent Goa. And finally, Indian forces, I think it was General K.P. Kandath, that was the operation for Goa liberation, which was codenamed Operation Vijay, which was to get back Goa from the clutches of the Portuguese. Now, subsequently, Goa fell, Portuguese terminated all diplomatic relations within India. With India, and I think it was in 1974 where Portuguese decided that it's no longer viable for them to not have any diplomatic relations with India, and they said that finally recognize okay, Baba, Goa is an official part of India, and they have started diplomatic relations with India. Now during all these things, our only friend in United Nations in other international matters was USSR. See, USSR was very different than what Russia is today, right? USSR was steadfast in supporting India and its interests in UN and other international forums. So Russia today is entirely different from what USSR was. That is why you cannot compare USSR with Russia right now. But let me tell you one thing. Whenever you are in a fight with Russia, always choose Russia, because Russia has become Russia has been that force of nature that everybody is afraid to fight with. So if you say you don't want Russia on your bad side, that is why the Chinese are also engaging with China, Chinese are also engaging with Russia, despite knowing that Russia is someday going to turn their back on Chinese. Because you don't want the, I think in a special episode, I think I'll do in history of Russia as such so that you can understand it. But Russia is a very interesting country, and the policies that they adopt are also very interesting. So moving on, that is the Liberation Day of Goa. So moving on to the next article, West Bengal bureaucrat transfer issue. So there was a particular issue in terms of a chief secretary that was appointed as an advisor to the chief secretary of Bengal was recalled by the central government by invoking a 2005 law. Now the problem with that was he was about to retire, and when the central government of India recalled him from the services, he opted for an early retirement and was appointed by the chief minister of Bengal as a special advisor to the chief minister for a period of 3 years. So we are not going into the political aspect of it. What we are talking about here are two things. One is the concept of extension for civil servants, and the second one is the central deputation aspect of the civil servants. Now what is the rule for the extension? The rule that we are going to understand about today, study about, is the rule 16(1) of death cum retirement benefit rules, which says that a member of the service may be given an extension of service for a period not extending 3 months in the public interest with the prior approval of the central government. So if the that is in the case if the officer is posted. Now, for an officer who is posted as a chief secretary of a state, the extension can be given for 6 months. For the rest of the officers, other than the chief secretary of the state, they get a 3 month extension. That's the end of it. But if he is retiring at the post of a chief secretary post of the state, which is the highest civil service post in a state, he or she may be given an extension of 6 months. Now, coming to the second aspect of it, that is the central deputation. So the practice in central is every year the central government asks for an offer list of officers from all India services willing to go for central deputation. Now again, the rule that is employed here is rule 6(1) of the IAS cadre rules, which again says an officer with the concurrence of the state governments concerned and the central government be deputed for a service under the central government or other state government. That is where you see various officers of other state cadre working in their respective states. Let us say an officer got allotted Maharashtra cadre when he was selected for IAS or other services, civil services on a whole. So what he does is he applies for a deputation to Andhra Pradesh, since he are in Kerala or Karnataka or Delhi, if he is from that respective state, through the deputation or these two central deputation, and goes and works there for a certain period of time. Now there are certain limitations as to how long he can serve, and it has to be in agreement from both the the central and the states involved, because he is moving from one state to other state on central deputation, and the cadre state and the whole receiving state also must give their consent for this transfer. So that is why there are problems. That is why we don't go into the political aspect of it. I just wanted to discuss about the extension aspect and the deputation aspect of it. Now there are certain issues, particularly in this case, because the central government has requested or recalled this particular officer in this case from his position of chief secretary of state of West Bengal, and he opted for early retirement. Now can the central government initiate certain actions on if officers don't heed to their requests or heed to their orders? Yes, central government can take action or impose punishment on officers until and unless the state he or she is working in agrees to it. So that is the rule 7 of All Indian Services Discipline and Appeal Rules 1969, where the authority to institute proceedings and to impose penalty with the state lies with the state government. So for any action to be taken against a civil servant that is serving, that is All Indian Services, the state that he is working in, and the central government both must agree to that fact that he needs to be punished or the punishment should be applied to. So moving on to the next article, China to allow couples for third child. Now China will be going for the first time will allow couples to have a third child in a further relaxation of family planning rules 5 years after the two child policy that largely failed to boost the birth rates. So remember this, the two child policy was not applicable to all of mainland China. China, that is not all mainland China, let us go with the China. So what they did was, in order to impose demographic changes in the territories that they have occupied, they gave an option to the citizens of Chinese that if you are willing to go and settle in those regions, particularly in Tibetan areas, in Xinjiang province or Shenzhen province, where they were doing this all these things with the Uyghurs and Tibetan people and Tibetan territory as such, they gave the citizens of China an option to say that if you are willing to uproot your livelihood from this area and go to those regions, the Tibetan regions, Xinjiang regions and other regions where the Chinese Communist Party was interested in performing demographic changes, you may be eligible to have two children. It was not applicable to all of China. It was only applicable to people who are willing to move from Chinese mainland to these occupied territories. So despite this, the principal idea was to do demographic changes, but that wasn't successful. So what was the fallout of this particular two child policy was, when the parents turned old, there was only one person to take care of both the aged parents. In our system, it is like we have two or three kids in most families. And when our parents get old, it happens to be that we have two people to take care of two people. Let us say a family of two has two children, it becomes a family of four. When both the mother and parent become old, the responsibilities of taking care of our parents lies with the siblings. So you have two kids who are entrusted with the job of taking care of two elderly people, and that is doable. That is absolutely doable, and you can take good care of these people. But what happened in the Chinese case was, when these people were forced to have only one children, when his parents or her parents got old, the entire responsibility of taking care of old parents got rested upon one child, which is highly impossible in a pressurized society as such of the Chinese. So first you have to understand it was done to do a demographic change in the occupied territories. The second was that it has become impossible for the children to take care of their parents because the societal pressures of Chinese are so high that they couldn't do it properly, and they wanted to address that also. Now they have embarked on a policy to allow couples to go for three children, and they have updated the two child policy to three child policy. And from looking at what these people are trying to do, it seems to statistically you have to understand that their birth rate fell. As a result of it, the sex ratio becomes skewed towards male. They have more males than females. And interestingly, that is why you see major cases of women being sold or traded to the Chinese from border areas of other countries that share border with China. You see a lot of cases of this coming out of Pakistan. You see a lot of cases of coming out of Vietnam and other South Asian countries that share border with China. They are going to that extent to at least get a balance of sex ratios in China. So again, the third child policy, though it seems that they are trying to address the skewed issue, the birth rate issues, but going at what we are seeing right now, it is going to be again a failure, because that kind of demographic changes that they were able to achieve earlier may not be translated to this generation. See, again, right, the traditions also do come into play. The Chinese society is a predominantly male children dominated society. There are a lot of parallels that can be drawn between the child policies of India and China, but nonetheless, right now we are on a trajectory where we are willing to go. We cannot compare what the Chinese societal policies to Indian policies. There is a lot of change in the society of India as too. So that gets into other discussion. But moving on to the next article. Moving on to the next article, how Pakistan plays the world. So we are well aware right now that US is in the process of pulling out its troops from Afghanistan. The date has been set for September 11th, and even the American troops have even agreed to transfer the base operations of Bagram Air Base to Afghan security forces. Bagram has been the epicenter of US operations in Afghanistan. Now, everybody understands the critical role that Pakistan played in terms of providing logistical support to US troops that are functioning in Afghanistan. For the past 20 years, Pakistan has played a very dirty game, in the sense that they have been using this leverage. The leverage that is, America was dependent on logistical supply routes for its troops from Pakistan. They have been playing very meticulous game, and they have been using US assets as their own for the past 20 years. To simplify it, Afghanistan is a landlocked country. It doesn't have access to ports. If you need access, port access from Afghanistan, there are only two countries. One is Pakistan, the second is Iran. The relationship between Iran and America has always been bad, good, worse, bad, good, worse. So nobody knows when the relationship will be bad, when the relationship will be worse, when the relationship will be good. So in terms of depending on for waging a war, in terms of creating a robust and consistent supply chain in terms of a war with Iran is out of question. So the natural partner became Pakistan, because they had presence in Pakistan since long, and they have a relationship with Pakistan since long, and they thought that they could trust Pakistan in getting an trust is a wrong word here, but they knew that Pakistan would help them in getting a logistical supply to Afghanistan with their help of Pakistan ports. Now, America was so dependent on Pakistan for its supply chain or supply links for its troops in Afghanistan, was that America was willing to overlook Pakistan's relations with China, for the sole fact that their troops would be cut off if Pakistan does anything stupid. Now, this is a watershed moment in terms of US-Pak relations. Now, America is going to pull out of its troops. So, it no longer needs the supply partnership of Pakistan. It no longer needs Pakistan ports for its troops. Don't you think they'll start rethinking about their policy of overlooking Pakistan, Pak-China relations? So that is what has happened here. Now, essentially what happened is, Pakistan has lost the leverage that it had over US for the past 20 years. Now, it has become a relationship. It has come to a point where Pakistan had to build a relationship with US based on Pakistan needs, not on US needs with Pakistan. So Pakistan doesn't, US doesn't need Pakistan anymore. So they don't give a 1 rupee about what Pakistan does. Now it has become very hard and a point of realization for Pakistan to recalibrate their ties with US. Now US will say, do what we are interested in, not what we won't do what you are interested in. So Pakistan doesn't want to alienate US, and Pakistan also doesn't want to alienate China. Now what Pakistan has essentially got itself into is a solid small space between China and US. Neither China will accept US interference in Pakistan affairs, neither US accepts China's interference in Pakistan affairs. It goes both ways. So it has to maintain and create a new dynamic relationship between US and China, all while managing a critically deepening crisis inside Afghanistan vis-a-vis Taliban and the government. So, if you go to Google and type who controls areas controlled by Taliban and Afghan government, you'll clearly see how much of area is controlled by Taliban, how much area is controlled by the Afghan government, and how much of area is contested between both of them. So this is the status quo both the Chinese and the Pakistanis would like to maintain in Afghanistan. The constant unknownness of who controls what or who has the authority over there. Now with America out of equation, there is a question of the Chinese assets also being in danger. Now they have to strike, Pakistan has to strike a balance between autonomy and alliance, meaning independently whether they want to operate or they want an alliance with these allies, which are US and China, and including Taliban also. Now they cannot do whatever they want inside Afghanistan because the security of US is gone. It may blow back into their own face. Now again, if America feels that any threat is going to come out of Afghanistan towards American soil, or if any threat is going to come out of Pakistan to US soil, America will not sit silently. They are going to retaliate or preemptively attack any part of Pakistan if they feel that some terrorist is going to come out of that region. Now that is also a credible threat to Pakistan because they don't need Pakistan anymore. Earlier there was a fear that if they attack on Pakistan, remember what happened with the Bin Laden raid? They didn't even inform the Pakistan intelligence as to they are going to conduct a raid in Abbottabad. Now how Pakistan is going to maintain a relationship with US and China? Now the equation of India also comes into play. Because Pakistan currently has a lot of insecurities with India. Because we categorically we have showed them that we can strike well within Pakistan when we want so. It's no question that whatever happened in Balakot was not in Pakistan occupied Kashmir or anything. Actually, it's part of true Pakistan. And we have been carrying out operations and functions, and we have been stabilizing that region into a perfect mixture of both security in terms of offensive and defensive. They are very well aware of what our capabilities are, and we are also very well aware of what their vulnerabilities are. Now, there is this concept where America is going to join hands with India particularly to try to weed out terrorism from Southeast Asia, particularly the region that surrounds us. There is a lot of terrorism that is brewing in certain regions in Southeast Asia, and India is also part of this global group effort to weed out terrorism from these regions. On its part, Pakistan also has signed a bilateral security treaty with US and also has joined the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization and Central Treaty Organizations in mid-50s, long back ago. Now, as far as this, how this alliance will transform into ground reality, that's up to Pakistan's behavior. Because the Chinese don't trust Pakistan as much as Pakistan trusts the Chinese, because again the Chinese play their own game and they do whatever they feel like doing. Now as far as the Pakistan and US relations, it is high time for them to adopt the change in ground realities. Now the Pakistan economy is down the drains right now. They are actually getting rice from Saudi Arabia. Actually, they went for money, even the foreign minister, everybody went to Saudi Arabia, including the prime minister, in the hope that they are going to give a loan. Instead, what they got were rice bags. What is the obsession as far as their economy is concerned? It's actually very bad right now, and even they are aware of how bad the situation is. If you even look at the internal security aspect, they recently went on a crackdown against extreme Islamist elements inside Pakistan, and we all know what happened. Essentially, the supporters of this particular leader laid a siege to capital cities of Pakistan and said that until and unless you are going to release him, we are going to wage a civil war against you. There were elements of certain Pakistan army itself showing allegiance to this radical Islamist leader, stating that they are going to wage a war against the Pakistani state. Now, there is a certain reality that has set into Pakistan, which cannot be trusted or should be taken with a grain of salt, that they have accepted what has happened with Kashmir in terms of the dissolution of Article 370 and the bifurcation of Jammu and Kashmir into Union Territories and Union Territory of Ladakh. But what happens is, it doesn't matter what Prime Minister of Pakistan says. It matters what the military of Pakistan says. So, yesterday, I think it was during in a press interaction or something like that, Prime Minister Imran Khan said that we are willing to talk with India when they are ready to restore Article 370 and restore the statehood of Jammu and Kashmir. At this point of time, it's a distant dream on both aspects of it. Now they have to come out of this obsession that they have with our internal security aspects and try to negotiate a deal that involves the internal security of Afghanistan. That's the only point of point where even America is willing to discuss with Pakistan, and the Chinese are also interested in discussing with Pakistan. Now, whatever the leverage that they had is gone, and whatever the insecurities that they have within India have increased, they haven't gone down. So we have to see how Pakistan will reinvent itself to sell again to Pakistan, or at least become useful to ensure regional peace, which is out of question at this point of time, but how they are going to balance between China and US. And as I said at the beginning of the article, they are stuck between two hard places, that is US and China. They have to reinvent themselves. They have a lot of stake right now, because India is the loser in case something happens in Pakistan. So it is going to have a direct impact on Indian internal security also. There is a lot of issues because of its nuclear assets. But if push comes to shove, I think US and India will kind of join hands in terms of securing the nuclear assets of Pakistan. But that's very long game that nobody is willing to play. But it's at the end of the day, internal security of Pakistan does lie in the hands of does have a direct implication on Indian internal security also, because you don't want an rogue state sharing a long border with you, and that too sometimes a porous border. Now we have to see how they are going to build new relations, how they are going to re-evolve, reinvent and come out of the quandary that they have got themselves into the first place. Now moving on to the next article, the new IT rules is not the way forward. So, the government of India had brought the Information Technology, Intermediary Guidelines and Digital Media Ethics Code Rules 2021. That is well known. One particular rule in those guidelines is Rule 4.2. This particular rules obligates to ensure traceability of originator of information on their platforms. Whatever the social media platforms, if the government invokes this particular rule, it is duty of the platform to find the originator of the information, meaning who posted it first on their platform, or where was it first posted from, which account was it posted first from, and who owns that account. These were put up for public in the meaning that the government of India gave ample time for social media platforms and digital media outlets to adhere to these rules. One day before the extension which was given by the government ended, WhatsApp approached the High Court of Delhi stating that, WhatsApp approached the Supreme Court stating, WhatsApp approached the Delhi High Court stating that this is a violation of India's fundamental rights, and right to privacy is a fundamental right. But one of the interesting things that came out of this particular issue between the government of India and the WhatsApp is the government reply. Whether you like it or not, it was a wonderfully worded reply, and they have been pretty spot on. One, they have been categorically stating that it is not up to Facebook, it is not up to the WhatsApp group, which is a private organization and an for-profit organization, to dictate the terms of Indian laws. Two, they have also been pretty clearly stating that they have invoked the Supreme Court judgment as to what is an absolute, no fundamental right is in absoluteness. Meaning, privacy, right to privacy is not an absolute right, because we have Supreme Court statements in case Puttuswamy stating that during certain cases there is a gray, there is an area where fundamental rights can be taken away, in the sense that there are certain areas where there can be restrictions applied on fundamental rights given to us by the Constitution of India. Now, coming back to the issue of traceability or the originator of the message, meaning they want to trace the origin of the message, so it's traceability. It's the issue where who is asking for the information, in this case government. So the government in the sense is the officers who are asking for the information. The particular problem that I found with this particular guidelines is, who is overseeing these officers? So the rule states that if an officer has asked for certain information from this social media company, the company must oblige and share the data. But what is lacking in this particular guidelines is the oversight over that officer. So if it is coming from a court order, we are well aware, we can be assured that the whatever the information is shared has the overseeing authority of the courts. A judge will be sitting over what the information will be done with. But in the case of the government, there is no overseeing authority as to what the officer is doing with the data. So that does create a problem, because you are essentially giving up a godlike power, or at least a part of a godlike power, to an officer who has nobody to control what they are doing or observe what they are doing. So that is the only issue that I found with this particular guidelines. And at the end of the day, the government has to come out and clearly indicate or come out clearly stating what their intention is, how they are going to manage the data once they receive the data, and what are the guidelines or the baseline for which they will be asking for data. Meaning, what constitutes a crime that allows the government to invoke this particular rule and ask for data. Until all these questions are answered, there will be a lot of pushback against the new guidelines. But as far as the WhatsApp company or the Twitter or anybody stating that we are the people who uphold the rights of citizens, all or that doesn't work in. See, at the end of the day, it's a private company, it's a for-profit company. We didn't elect those companies. It's up to us to elect our leaders, and it is up to us to enact laws and uphold our laws. It's no space for private companies to play governments with our elected representatives. Whether you like the government or not, it's irrelevant. What they are directly are essentially doing is challenging the democratically elected systems in India. We have institutions, we have checks and balances, we have democratically elected leaders. If anything goes wrong, it is us, the people of this country, that should be questioning this elected leaders or the institutions. It is not up to the private company to dictate the laws or sidestep the judicial process and legislation in the country. They have to accept the laws of the land. If they don't want to do, they just can simply go. And this is not negotiable. It's about the sovereignty of the country. It's about the independence of the country. Private companies cannot be allowed to do this. You can see clearly what will happen if private companies are given extensive power in terms of controlling speech and controlling right to express thoughts or freedom of speech. That is what has happened in US, and we don't want that repeat in India also, because things will go badly from there. So it's not about how the company feels, how you feel about the company. It's when you boil everything down, it comes to a private company, that to a for-profit company, not even functioning out of India, functioning out of some other country, questioning the laws that was enacted by our elected leaders. So if they say that they are going to uphold the rights of the citizens, who are they to uphold? We have our constitution, we have our courts, we have our legislative, we have our executive. These are the people whom we hold for upholding laws, we hold accountable to, not private companies. Get that into mind. So moving on to the next article, what explains the surge in FDI inflows? So this particular article is interesting because the Indian government has came out and said that we have clearly seen an increase in FDI inflow of around 81.7 billion, almost 10% over what we have been seeing in the last year. Now the Ministry of Commerce and Industry in a press release stated that we have seen almost all 81.7 billion as FDI into India. Now, one of the questions that we or somebody had was, how come India had so much of FDI when the economy is doing so badly? So the two things that explain the sudden increase in gross inflows is, one is direct investment to India, second is disinvestment into money. Now when you separate the data that was given, you can clearly see that around 47% of money was disinvestment accounts for the rise in gross inflows. So these are the important articles for the week of this week. Every week on Saturday at 5 p.m. I'll be posting new episodes. Hope you like, subscribe. From next week, the articles will be far less and far more informative. This is a trial episode that I wanted to do for a short period of time. From next week onwards, as I said, subscribe to Perseverance IAS podcast. This is Perseverance IAS Weekly. You can get this on Perseverance IAS YouTube channel or Perseverance IAS podcast YouTube channel. Thanks for listening and stay safe.